Hello, you're listening to Shop Talk Show. This week's episode is sponsored by Majingo, which we'll talk about in a minute. Let's get this thing started.
Ladies and gentlemen, hello, you're listening to Shop Talk Show. This is episode 19, and this episode is going to be another one of our rapid fire episodes.
The soothing sounds of a machine gun. Welcome everybody to Shop Talk Show.
That's people often say, more machine gun, more
they
machine
like
gun. They like it. They love it. People in their machine guns, man.
More of it.
Well, cool. So if you've listened to this show for any amount of time, you already know, but rapid fire episodes are our chance to kind of just, break away from the hustle and bustle of having guests and hilarious jokes and all that and get straight into question on question answers.
Action.
There you go. That's So, Chris?
Let's just kick it right off. All questions all the time. We got one from Ethan Miller who says, he has a question about Ajax pagination, WordPress, and SEO. I recently implemented Ajax pagination on a site, largely because it looked so slick. So you know what we're talking about, right? You click the button to maybe see next posts. And the page itself doesn't refresh in the browser. No little spinny thing. It just kind of some stuff disappears and some stuff just scoot right in without having the page refresh. That's what Ajax is all about. And then realized that web crawlers have trouble indexing sites where the navigation is handled with Ajax. I've come across a few solutions to this problem. Google itself has something about making Ajax links readable through a special hashtag. But the solution is complex, and you have to set up a whole new mechanism for page loading, other than the one that's built into WordPress. I've found some sites that claim that Google will, in the future, teach its web crawler about to follow links handled in JavaScript / jQuery. I'm wondering if you have come across any good solutions to this problem, and what's the state of thinking on this technique? So you know what he means there?
Yeah, so like Ajax pagination, and then is it kind of a problem because of SEO and all that?
A lot of times, I think he's talking about that hash bang kind of thing, which Twitter uses a whole bunch, right? So twitter.com, and then there's like a hashtag and an exclamation point, and then another slash, and then like kind of the URL where they're trying to get to. Mm-hmm. Which looks like a real URL, but as soon as there's a hashtag in a URL, that's just the hash. It's not, the browser doesn't really interpret the rest of it. It's just the rest of it is just this arbitrary string at the end of it, which has some special functionality in web browsers. If an ID matches what's that hashtag is, the page will kind of scroll itself down to that point. It's just a way, it's just like an arbitrary signifier kind of thing. And it was thus picked up by Ajax Techniques because of that kind of the ability of it. You can change the hash on a page to something else. It'll look like the URL is a different URL, but to the browser, it's basically the same URL. Uh-huh. So the page doesn't reload. And I would say you don't have to use hash bangs to... I'd say that all the links on your page, if it's a WordPress site or anything else, your actual links shouldn't have hash bangs in them. That would be an SEO problem because that, without JavaScript turned on, anybody following a link that was used this hash bang technique, it would just go to whatever your homepage is. So it wouldn't be able to follow the proper place where that link goes. But you don't need hash bangs in the links themselves. You can capture a link on a page through JavaScript, and you can kind of process it or do whatever with that href, and still you can implement Ajax stuff without without Ajax links. I don't know. That's what I'm trying to say here. I feel like I'm blowing it a little bit, but
no, I think you're fine. Yeah, I mean, so you can do Ajax pagination, and it's not illegal. You need to have a fallback. Like, that's like web 101. You need the site to work even without JavaScript, probably.
Absolutely. And that this Ajax thing is just an enhancement to that. So I made a WordPress theme once called All Ajax, and it was no different than any other. It was just this little JavaScript layer that sat on top of a WordPress theme that worked completely fine without JavaScript. You would just click a link and you would go to a blog post. But the Ajax layer would like intercept that click. And instead of changing the URL, it would change the URL to a hash URL, you know, using the push state thing in JavaScript. And then it would just take the – it would do an Ajax request for that URL that was in the link, figure out what the main content area was, then delete them or, you know, disappear the main content area from the page you're currently on and drop in the new content it grabbed from that URL. So it was fine. Google would have no problem with the site crawling it because it doesn't care about JavaScript. The site works fine without JavaScript. But with JavaScript on, any internal link click, it would just behave in this new way. It would just kind of Ajax in the new content instead. So I just don't think SEO is necessarily a big problem. Just because your site uses Ajax doesn't mean search engine is going to have a problem with it.
I mean, if you look at like big sites like Lifehacker and Gizmodo, they all do Ajax pagination, and maybe they did suffer a hit because I think they did it wrong the first time or something. But they kind of depend on all that, so they're probably just fine, I would guess.
And take a look when you go to their site, roll over a link. It's not a hashbang link, it's a real link that really goes to a real place with real content on it. And then if you click it, maybe it does something else in the URL bar, but the links are still, you know, canonical or whatever they call that.
Yeah. I would just be careful how you're doing it. So there's a thing made if you're not on WordPress, if you're like building a Rails app, there's this thing called PJAX, and it's made by the GitHub guys. It's pretty awesome. It's like a jQuery plugin that does all this, and then you sniff a request header that's like server stuff, but you sniff this header, and you just say, oh, if I see this, there's no layout. I just send the content, basically.
Yeah, that's nice. That was the problem with Google, because if you just make a request for a page that just like any other page, you're going to get a lot more junk with it. You're going to get the doc type and the head and all of that stuff. So what you're saying is when you make a request through Ajax, just give me just the content. Where if this is a regular non-Ajax request, I'm going to need the whole page.
Yep.
Is that the idea?
Yeah. It's kind of cool.
I was trying to work that into the Ajax theme a little bit. Like maybe if I detect that it's Ajax, I can just do like just spit out in WordPress the content. And don't spit out, and then else do all the get head, get footer, get, you know, all that other stuff.
Yeah, no, I tried it. I think you'd have to modify, like, you just have to say if not request Ajax or whatever, or request
there's
PJAX.
There's a special PHP function to detect this, right?
Yeah, well, or just when you say get header, just before that, you say if this isn't a PJAX, then get header, else do nothing. So it's kind of cool little tricks you can do there, but I'm sure, Ajax is interesting and it's sometimes easy and sometimes completely a like crap storm. So careful out there, Ethan.
crap storm sound.
Oh, I'm.
Oh, we got an audio question here from Nick Johnson.
Oh, hold on. We should probably... There we go. Back on track here. So from Nick, here we go.
Hey, guys. I wanted to see if you've ever been in a situation where you've worked with back-end developers who have been resistant to maintaining semantic markup that's given to them, making the case that some of the automated processes that are built into certain frameworks make their job faster and their development faster. even though it produces not optimal HTML. I was wondering if you had any advice on how to handle situations like that. Thanks a lot.
So the developers are making non-semantic HTML.
I would think an example of that. It's nice if people have questions like this. Just throw us the exact scenario in, because usually people have something in mind. You know, so let's, you know, and it's funder to talk specifics. Right away, I thought of, like, let's say you upload an image in WordPress through their media uploader thing and then say insert into post. WordPress will give you that image tag and it will give you a bunch of class names and stuff on it that are of its deciding, you know. And I'm like, well, what if you wanted to have it output in a figure tag? That would be maybe like what we would do naturally because we're like hip HTML5 designers. But this guy, but our clients might say, well, I'd love to use a figure tag, but I can't because WordPress doesn't give it to me. And I want the people producing content for us to just use the built-in tools.
Yeah.
And not, yeah. So I don't know what to tell you.
I know in like Rails, there are gems. Ruby on Rails has a bunch of, or Ruby has gems and Rails uses them. But there's a lot of form builder plugins, and developers will use these because it makes their life so much easier. You just type input ninjas and then it's like a text field and it's got, you know, a label, sure, a text field, and then it's hooked into your, what your data model needs to be. And I know people are pretty opinionated about these. Some are good, some are bad. So, man, I don't know what to tell you. I mean, yeah, like let's say it wraps your inputs in a P tag instead of like a ULLI tag or something like that. Maybe you really want the LI instead of a P tag. I would think I would just bend to the developer's will, unless it's like, I mean, if it's like god awful, I would do something like, if it's got a bunch of like on click events like stuffed inside of it, I would maybe say something. A lot of like,
you got to decide whether the fight is worth fighting or not, right? If it's the difference between a P and an LI, you'd be like, dude, whatever, you know, like maybe I have an opinion about that, but that's one you want to save your energy to fight another day, maybe. But if it's pure garbage, then you should speak up and be like, hey, this should be type email. There's lots of advantages to type email. Have you ever typed your email on an input on a phone? It's nice when you get the email keyboard. So I want to have that happen. And you as developer, you know, we as designers and developers need to work together to make this better user experience happen. You know, you want to be, I don't know, you know what I mean, right?
Yeah.
Do it by the user. Don't have these little internal fights and bickering. Like, just fix the damn thing.
Yeah, I think you can, yeah, you got to choose your battles. And I think, you know, your developer being the gatekeeper is sometimes bad. But then again, they've kind of got the architecture of the whole entire site in their brain, you know? So you gotta be. So it's like whatever's easiest, most maintainable code is what they're kind of most interested in. Sometimes. Yeah, maybe we need a certain specific situation, but.
So we understand what you're saying, Nick. You know, just sometimes developers are right. You know, if you're gonna battle your developer on one because they're doing something you don't think, are they really screwing up? Because if they really are screwing up, you should fight the battle. And if it's in the realm of trivial and not gonna screw up your life, just kind of let them do their thing.
Agree. Boom. Next question is from Johnny Suter. I just opened a GitHub account and was starting to read into the tutorials and understand a bit more about how it works and how it can benefit my work. I was wondering if there are any tools, recommendations you or Dave might have. This is to you, Chris. You or Dave might have for someone just getting started.
Yeah, so Git. He's just started Git. How do you do Git? There's lots of resources for sure. I know it's intimidating, but it's not that bad. So if you're on a Mac, one nice thing is to just try the GitHub for Mac app. So anything that you've read about Git and it makes it sound complicated, the GitHub for Mac app does its best to hide anything complicated at all about version control. All of the GitHub like vernacular, like forking and rebasing and all that stuff, is hidden from this app. There's no buttons that say rebase in the GitHub for Mac app. It's meant like for users, not for programmers. So I would try that, and like if you don't care, but if you're like trying to get into Git because you want to be a hardcore Git hero, there's plenty of books. You know, there's Pro Git, there's Git from the Ground Up, there's Getting Good with Git. Here's the resource. I did a screencast, by the way. Let's suck at GitHub together, and I was much worse at GitHub then. But I was like, I know I need to do this, and it was me struggling through it. So maybe you'll be able to relate to me in that video. So check that out. But Brad Frost did a post on Google Plus the other day saying that he sucks at Git, and so he's just amalgamated some resources together. So I'll put a link to that in the show notes that says here's roundups, walkthroughs, references, articles, the different software you can use, all that stuff. So, Johnny, we feel you. Getting used to Git is a weird place to be, but there's lots of resources out there for you. Well, how did you learn, Dave?
Trial by fire, really. And I'm not a pro by any means, but I think...
Have you ever rebased something?
Yeah, and it doesn't feel comfortable, but it's... Yeah. You're just... You don't know what happens. I mean, Yeah, because you just type git rebase and it's just like doing it, done. And you're just like, I don't get what happened, but it just like flattened your whole structure or something. I mean, maybe I'm even wrong there.
Well, yeah, no, that's right. Because I saw a cool presentation at a bar camp the other day. I've already told the story about the Tinker Toys.
No. Mm-hmm. No,
like Git for Tinker Toys or something. So, you know what a Tinker Toy is? It's like a long stick, and then there's little connectors that are like circles, and the circle has little holes all the way around it, maybe eight or something. And you just stick a stick in a circle and kind of build something out of it. And so, in this metaphor, the sticks were like you doing some coding, and then the little circles were commits. And because I think that's how it worked.
So like you'd have branches. Like
yeah, it's easy to branch, right? That's the point. Or a circle is kind of a branch. And it was neat because there's a head at each one of the the head in Git is this really like just arbitrary concept. It's just a little label at which branch happens to be the one that is the head at the moment. But there was let's say you're writing some code and it's just sticks. Circle, stick, circle, stick, circle, really nice flat structure. And then one of the circles, you decide to make a branch. So now you've split the main code into two different paths. And let's say one of those paths just keeps getting commits, and then you want to merge the two. Well, that's really easy because they just kind of smush together nicely. But if there's commits on both branches, it gets a little bit more complicated. When you go to merge those, it has trouble doing it because there's kind of commits on both sides. So one way to do it is I think you can kind of just force it, but when you do that, you get these like bubbles, right? Mm. Your Git commit history has these like alternate paths that then reconnect. So it gets harder to back up because you're like, which way do I back up? Which like path do I take backwards? So having a flat history is a lot nicer than having these bubbles in your history.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which is why a lot of people instead of Git pull, they like, I don't know. I feel weird even talking about this because I feel like I'm going to get made fun of. But rebasing is all about trying to keep your history flat so that if you do need to back up at any point, it's clean.
Yeah, yeah. Because, yeah, if you wanted to jump back a commit, like, oh, dang, the background's supposed to be pink. That was 10 commits ago. You would basically have to, like, jump back 10 commits and then... Yeah, yeah. That's why GUIs are awesome. I hope that helps, Johnny. I think, yeah, there's tons of resources, but I think just realize getting started, everyone sucks at it. It's not like for developers, I feel like, you know, serious neckbeards, it's like a very easy, simple concept. You're just like, of course I do that, you know? But if like you don't do it, if you're like a lone, what do they call it? Lone developer or
What was I remember that, and now I can't remember even. That was awesome. Only child developer.
If you're an only child developer, like, it's not going to make sense. It's not going to be intuitive because you, like, have to teach yourself. But, man, just suck at it together and then maybe find a friend who sucks at it. And then, like, you guys make a dummy project and you start committing to each other from different computers until, you know, like, you guys feel comfortable.
You'll have conflicts that you have to work through.
Yeah, like, both start working on a file and both push and see what happens, and somebody's going to get a message that says, like, meh, meh, can't do that. And then, like, so you have to figure it out. I think trial by fire is the best way. So, speaking of fire, boom! Next question. Related, Asmodeus says, I'm an old school web dev and I'm wondering why Git versus just using tried and true FTP.
I put this in here because it's kind of one of those. Asmo has like these two, he's just confusing some concepts, I guess. Like comparing Git to FTP is one of those like apples versus oranges scenarios. And I'm sure there's other people in Asmo's boat, right? FTP is a protocol for transferring files around, and Git is like a what would you call it? A project or language or system for version control. They just aren't. You know, do you have a way to explain this?
Yeah, so Git has little to do with deployment, although it can be tied to it. What Git is basically how you're saving the file. You're writing a commit message every time you're saying, boom, this is finally it, mark it. Like, mark it, Donnie. This is a really good version of this file. This is my official submission here. And then FTP is, you know, just slewing files over the server, you know, from one server to another.
It hangs out with HTTP, you know, it's just kind of whatever, you know, it's a network protocol or whatever for transferring files across. So they just don't live in the same basket. But they, you know, I understand how that could be confused in your head, right? Because you're like, I want to run a site. One of the ways that I can maintain my site is logging in through FTP and making edits to files and saving them over my FTP connection to my web server, and that's how I maintain the site. And sometimes sites are version controlled, and you change files on your site and you commit them through Git, and that's how, and then, you know, you go through some deployment step, and that's how you control your site. So they live in the same basket in that way, is that you can use these technologies to maintain a site, but really, They are very different things. So you can use them together. For example, you could commit to Git and then have some service watch your Git repository and see that something has changed, and then it will deploy those new files through FTP. So that's a possibility.
Yeah. So Git, you can set up Git to. That's where this is getting smart. If you make a commit to your master branch on Git, there are hooks that you can say, deploy this, boom, make it live, make it real, and it will do that. The best way I can describe it is sign up for a Heroku account. Make like a folder on your computer called my cool site, and then make an index.php, write what hello world in it, and then crack open the command line. You'll have to cd into that directory. It's kind of it'll make you feel uncomfortable, but once you learn it, you're okay. You know, type git init git sorry, you have to install the Heroku gem. I'm not making this sound easy, but you just do gem install Heroku. You may have to do some configuring there, but then once that's done, you just do git init git add dot git commit dash m my commit message git push Heroku, and that's it. And your website's live on Heroku. Like, it once you've got this down, you just do git push Heroku, and it's like there instantly on the internet. It's mm-hmm. cool.
So Heroku's dealing with the deployment for you, yeah. which is what, like, it's that is taking the role of FTP in this case.
So I guess I'm just saying, like, if the advantage of git versus FTP in terms of deployment, which is, I think, the heart of his question, is that there can be some pretty sweet streamlined things. Like, you're not like dragging individual files up to a server, or you're not like, you know, selecting all files and dragging them across your desktop into the FTP server. You know, it's really like super fast, like boom, just push all the changes and all the changes go up and then it's live again. So,
yeah. So ASMO, the difference is, FTP involves no version control. So you're calling it tried and true FTP because it sounds like you're more comfortable with that. That's fine. Just know that when you push up a file with just FTP, if you're using no version control, it's just a little dangerous these days. It's just you're not using any of the power and beauty of version control. So that's it.
Cool. Next. Awesome. Boom. Next question from. Do you want to read this one? You got this one.
Nicola Zanin asks, in your opinion, what is the best responsive images technique? Is there one that is totally bulletproof? That one with the NoScript tag seems to be the best because the image in the NoScript tag never starts downloading. Just last episode, where we were talking with old Mean Gene, about some responsive... We did a whole thing on responsive images, and this is something that we'll definitely keep an eye on and keep talking about at Shop Talk Show because it's just very interesting and relevant kind of thing going on in the world right now. And I guess just listen to that episode first, Nicola. Yeah. But also, he makes a good point about the NoScript. Have you seen these?
I have. It's cool. It feels a little dirty, but it's pretty cool.
A little bit, yeah. I'm not totally sure how I feel about it, too. Let me set the stage for us here. You would have an image tag, IMG, and then in that image, you might have like a data URL that says data-source and then the source of your image and close it. That is invalid and non-semantic because it doesn't have a source attribute. You're skipping the source attribute. And then right after that image tag, you would have a NoScript tag, and then you would put a semantic version of that same image in there. You'd have image, and then you'd say source equals, and then actually point to the image. Now, if we just left it at that, let's say you bring up a browser with JavaScript turned off, you'll get the image. And if you bring in a browser with JavaScript turned on, you'll basically get nothing. But that's where then you load up a script, and the script grabs the data source, probably does a little magic to figure out exactly what it wants to do based on screen size or bandwidth or whatever, then puts a source into that image, a real source, and then that image starts downloading. The beauty of doing it this way is that only one image will ever be requested for an image. You're sacrificing semantics and validity for efficiency. And, you know, most people are willing to make that trade, but, you know, it's kind of up to you.
Yeah. What's your current best if you had to choose today?
Ugh. I'd probably that's so hard. I like High Source by Christopher Schmidt, but if I was starting a new brand new thing today, I'd probably go with that. It's so hard to say, though, but that one is like, if you want to be semantic with it, you do have to deal with the two image downloading problem. I'm not totally down with the transparent GIF method. Mm-hmm. I think I like the adaptive images one because most of the things that I work on have all this legacy content. CSS Tricks has just thousands of posts on it, and I don't have the ability to go back and change the markup for all those images. It's just not going to happen. So I like the ones that, that just can deal with the issue without that. And that's what adaptive images does. That's the one that routes images requests through an HTXS file, through a PHP file, and then kind of like will scale down an image automatically mm-hmm. if need be. I just think that's nice, but it doesn't feel long term. I'm kind of hoping that just you know, browsers in conjunction with the W3C just come up with something for us that just works.
Yeah. Huh.
What's the best technique, Nicola? I don't know.
But one you choose.
Do look at us. There is a post on the blog.cloud4.com by Jason Grigsby, who goes through this epic three-part series on responsive images, and he makes some calls about how the best way to handle this is. A really comprehensive set of articles, so I'll link those up.
Cool. All right. Boom. This is Robert Farr. So the next one is an audio question from Chase Woodford. Let me cue it up here.
Hey, guys. I'm working on a website redesign, and I've been looking for a tool that could crawl a CSS file into a repository and output a list matching where styles are found on pages in that repository. The website I'm working on has a ton of different pages, but really only uses one massive style sheet. And I'm looking for an easy way to identify which styles can be removed from the style sheet after the redesign, because they're no longer being used. Over the years, this website has gone through a number of minor redesigns, and I know for sure that there are things inside the style sheet that either no longer exist or can be written in a more effective way. And I don't really want to start fresh on the style sheet because the redesign is more focused on like moving content around, like consolidating content and optimizing the pages. And it's not really an overhaul of the page aesthetics. Chris, I know you were talking about going through a site redesign. And I was just wondering if you had any knowledge of tools that could do something like this that could match the CSS to the places in the repository where that CSS is actually being used.
Googling find unused styles.
You know, so page speed, Google page speed used to dock you, like give you minus points. It would say remove unused styles from page. And so I thought, aha, I'm going to answer this guy's question, but now it doesn't do it anymore. So,
oh really?
So it used to like bust you like, oh, you have table in your CSS, but no tables in your markup? Lame. But you would have to like by hand, or I guess you could automate it, but you'd have to by hand like check every page. So that's not fun. But
no, at least every like template, you know, because you probably don't have to look at every page on your site. So people, if you don't understand, you know, because you might just be like, well, I don't know, just remove some styles and look at the page and see if anything changed. Not that simple, because like you're saying, one style sheet here is covering every page on the whole site. So as soon as you make one little change to that that style sheet, especially removing something, you'll have to. You have to just look at a ton of pages to make sure that it didn't do anything. There's some intelligent, if there's a class name called .poll or whatever, maybe you can just do a search in project. If you have the whole local project, search in project for the word poll and just look through the search results and see if anything is currently using that class name. If it is, you definitely need that CSS. You can do little things like that. I don't know of a tool that will crawl your whole site, you know, figure out every one of your rules and like be able to point you specifically at rules that aren't used throughout your entire site. And do it like really reliably and safely. There may be things like that. I mean, I just Googled it and I found like unused-css.com. Let me run it, see how it works.
Yeah, I was going to run it on my site, see what happens. One thing that might help is to refactor your CSS and make sure it's grouped smartly and nicely. And then you would probably be like, oh, why am I... You know, you'd have to touch every single line of CSS, but, you know.
It's certainly a problem. I can sympathize with the situation that you're in, you know. It's kind of nice when there's one guy working on it. So, like, you are more in touch with your, with
yeah.
what you've done.
Yeah.
Let's see. Explore one page of your site. So this isn't that cool. It looked at one page and then put a graph. Explore all the pages.
Yeah, it's telling me I'm not using most of my stuff, which is probably true.
Probably too for the homepage, you know.
Yeah.
But like, if that's okay, if you run this thing and you find out that half of your styles aren't being used on your homepage, that means still the cache is primed for when every you go time. To an yeah. article page. It's that. I mean, that means there's a bunch of stuff in there that's kind of ready to rock when you hit a subpage. Good luck.
I really do think going through your CSS, if that's possible, and grouping it really well will probably save your life. It'll let you know, like, oh shoot, we don't have a dogs module anymore, so I'm just going to delete all the dog.css stuff or whatever. So hope that helps. You probably didn't. All right. Next question. Oh, next thing is a sponsorship. Howdy ho. Chris, you want to do this?
Yeah. Well, we're very lucky to have Mijingo as a sponsor. That's Mijingo.com. It's a project by Ryan Ireland, who's a developer at Happy Cog. A very smart dude. They use a lot of Expression Engine at Happy Cog, although they can do anything. I don't want to pigeonhole them like that. They're an incredibly good design agency. Mijingo is separate, of course, from Happy Cog. It's just his personal project where he does like intermediate level screencast style training. Right, and I call it intermediate level because it's not just, you know, Ryan doesn't have like learn CSS, you know, like that's been covered a lot of times by a lot of people. That's great stuff. I love that stuff too. But it's kind of cool to see a project like Mijingo here, which is, you know, aimed at people with a little more under their belt development wise. So it's called Mijingo.com. You can go, for example, they have, if you want to learn Expression Engine and even kind of taking Expression Engine to the next level and customizing it and doing some fancier stuff with it, they got you covered here. But one of the ones there right on the homepage right now is just called Learning Expression Engine. It's 4 hours of HD screencasts of learning, you know, I mean, and you can get a lot done in that time. Believe me, I'm sure that takes you from zero to hero in Expression Engine. And you pay for, you know, there's no coupons, there's no messing around here. You pay $48, you get the 4 hours of video, and that's the way it is. So I like it, the straightforward approach. So we're lucky to have them. Thanks so much for sponsoring Shop Talk Show, Mijingo.com.
Awesome. Thank you very much, Mijingo. All right, we're going to move on. Next question is from Antonio Letieri, and it's an audio question. I love these. Here we go.
Hi guys, wanted to hear your thoughts on unobtrusive JavaScript or progressive enhancement. So when you're developing your site or even your application, do you account on the fact that JavaScript is going to be more than likely enabled on your audience's browsers and aren't too concerned about progressively enhancing your site or app? I ask this mostly because I've been looking at some JavaScript MVC frameworks and began to wonder if applications or sites that are developed on these JavaScript MVC frameworks would actually work without JavaScript enabled. So I wonder if progressive enhancement is becoming a thing of the past, and whether or not being concerned about JavaScript being enabled in the browser is becoming a thing of the past. Thanks a lot, guys.
Yeah, I mean, this is similar to that first question we were talking about, the Ajax pagination.
But, yeah, but in the case of Ajax pagination, we were saying it should work either way. It should work with JavaScript or without. I think at the moment you choose to use an MVC JavaScript framework, you're turning your back on users without JavaScript. Right?
Yeah. That's a heavy debt investment, or like tech investment. So
yeah.
It depends on context. I mean, you can deploy Backbone through PhoneGap to an iPad app if you wanted. I mean, in that case,
wouldn't rely on JavaScript anymore because it's now native code.
Yeah, and then it would be native. Right. I don't think you can turn off JavaScript inside of an app like that. In some ways, he's totally right. I feel like, I mean, I used to disable JavaScript back in the day because it was like, pop-up ads, you know, mm-hmm. awful. But I feel like, you know, especially with like Google, like Chrome and speed, you know, page speed, and I feel like the JavaScript's being used for good, and as long as it keeps building that trust, people will enable it. But if you do douchebag stuff, and I've done that in the past, that's what
a lot of that pop-ups, you know, like if that's the number one problem, browsers realize that most of them have pretty good pop-up blocking these days. You know, you still can do the, you know, based on a click, you can still have pop-up issues, but for the automatically opening ones, it's browsers are pretty good at blocking them. I'm going to go out and say, I don't care. I would happily use a JavaScript MVC framework. I would put some kind of query in there that says, and we do this on Wufoo as well. If you log into Wufoo, the first page that you see, if you have JavaScript off, is a full page block out. There's a pop up window that says, I'm sorry, this site just doesn't work without JavaScript. If that's a huge problem for you, I guess we're willing to lose you, you know, like it would be too much of an investment for us to make every single feature of Wufoo work, without JavaScript, that it's just not worth it for us development time wise.
Yeah. No, I mean, you can't have Facebook feeds and like buttons and stuff without JavaScript. So
you use the word progressive enhancement and graceful degradation as a big concept, as a, the site works or doesn't work. You can still use those concepts for little things, you know? Like if your site like CSS Tricks is just a blog. ShopTalkShow.com is just a blog basically that with little audio elements on it. It's easy for us to make our site work without JavaScript. So if we're going to add a little feature that's JavaScript-y, we might call it progressive enhancement and say, hey, this site still works without JavaScript. And we could still use the label progressive enhancement. But for big apps, yeah, maybe those days are over.
Yeah, it's possible. It's possible. It's sort of, yeah. Ah, I still want to be purist and be like, truth be told, you need JavaScript to make things kind of get together and work, you know.
Get together.
To work real well. And to be fast. I mean, like, you know, you shouldn't always need to reload the page just to save something. Or something like that.
So, totally agree.
Ah, well, okay. I think that's a good question. I want to hear what people think. So write in your stuff or call in your stuff. Okay. All right. Next question, Noel McGlinchey. My question regards Google Analytics. What would you consider to be a good starting point for getting the most out of this tool? Do you have, Chris, you use Google Analytics, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's just one of those like no-brainers. You just throw it on every website because you don't want to be blind to that stuff. If for no other reason, it's fascinating to track what your traffic is like. You know, if you ever deal with advertisement, that's the one of the first questions they ask is wanting to know how much traffic you get. And you can't really, you know, there's theoretically third-party tools that tell you the traffic of other sites, but they don't know, you know, they rely on Alexa or whatever that some people choose to install this toolbar somehow, and it tracks where those people go, and that's supposed to extrapolate into their global traffic, which is just laughable, I feel like. But Google Analytics is not laughable. It will give you the exact numbers of people that visit your website, unless they have JavaScript turned off, in which case it doesn't track those people because Google Analytics is JavaScript dependent. I think there might be some PHP ways to like report to them. I'm not exactly sure, but
true. He also has there's a second part of the question, like if you do use it, does it play a big part in the upkeep of your websites? I would say absolutely.
It does? Okay.
I mean, well, we go through some sites and like if a page is getting 0% or like even like 1%, you know, like, and it has like 100% bounce rate. I mean, dude, get rid of it. Like if content's not performing for you, just nuke it, man. It's it's just, I mean, unless like you're going real long tail, like CSS tricks or something, like you really want like,
yeah, maybe. I mean, there's no benefit for me to nuking an old article. Really?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think more for like clients, like, I mean, mm-hmm. you know, if you
don't let that page weigh you down or something, don't.
Yeah, exactly. Like, so let's use like an example, like every client wants like the FAQ page, you know, cause they think like everyone's got all these pre-prepared questions they, you know, so they click on FAQ and, you know, like chances are your FAQ page isn't doing very well. It's just a page you made up to like put a bunch of crap in. So you can see how well that page is performing. See if it's in your top 5, 10, 100 pages. And, you know, if it's not, then that's maybe a page you should target on reworking and making it actually work. Or if the information isn't valuable, get rid of it, sort of. That's my – less content is easier for people to digest in the long run. So,
good stuff.
Yeah. And you can A/B.
Dude, it's hard. Google Analytics as a whole, you shouldn't go into Google Analytics blind. Don't crack open Google Analytics and decide, whatever I find in here is going to guide my future. Because then you're going in without any. I think instead what you should do is have some like hypothesis or question that you're trying to have be answered by analytics, and then gather data on it, make sure that you're gathering the correct data, and then go in there and look and try and have analytics answer your question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
because otherwise you're flying blind. You're like, oh, look at what's popular on my site. What does that tell you? Does that tell you should do more of that, or does it tell you that's just where people happen to land? But maybe you'd do better if you focused on not that. Know what I'm saying? It's like the symptom, not the cause, or whatever.
Right.
Or the cause, not the symptom. When I was a little addicted to it in the early days of CSS Tricks, being like, where's my traffic coming from? What's going on today? And I would just spend so much time in there until I realized that I don't actively react to anything that I learned from that. I just got a kick out of looking at it, but it didn't help me grow. It didn't help me make decisions. It was just this time sink of nothingness. So I very rarely crack it open today, just for the kind of data for advertisers. But that, you know, there are some smart Google Analytics people out there. There's people that could look at my analytics and make analysis and figure out things I could do. And those people are valuable. They're just not me. So I don't want to say Google Analytics is useless. It's kind of an advanced skill.
Yeah. I think it's a full-time job. Totally. Mm. So indeed. To be good at it. So, there we go. Next question. Nassim Donald is asking, is there an alternative for the following non-CSS3 browsers? Body, Overflow X, Hidden. Is there?
No. Next.
No. Next. Overflow Hidden should work for you, but you need Overflow X. Unfortunately, I don't think that's going to do it for you. So, yeah, you wouldn't want to do body over. Yeah, oh, so you have a container problem if you're doing Overflow X Hidden, probably. So.
Yeah, and you might be worried about like really long strings with no spaces in them breaking out of stuff, in which there's ways to deal with that without needing to hide overflow, like break word. You're trying to fix up if you're trying to do body overflow X hidden, you're treating again a symptom instead of a cause or whatever, right? You're like drinking whiskey because you got a cough when you need to like stop going outside in the cold.
Probably need to stop drinking. No. Anyway, I there's not, unfortunately, but I would look at reworking your container. That's probably what's going wrong there. So, okay, let's go to the next question. Mm-hmm. You want to read it, Chris?
Sure. Scott Little asks, it seems like a lot of people, myself included, slander email as being inefficient, time-consuming, and just generally annoying and unmanageable. Why is nobody coming up with viable alternatives that we know of? I don't mean a new app like Sparrow that makes email easier. I'm talking about a proper alternative to email altogether. Wow. Mm.
That's deep, dude.
I think they are doing that. I think everybody's doing that all the time.
Yeah. I mean, Facebook's an alternative to email. I mean, you know.
Twitter's an alternative in a weird way. Google tried to do just that, and they said that's what they're doing. They said
Google Wave
is what email would be if we could abandon the legacy of it. And you saw that where that went, right? I'm sure there's some people listening that are like, what? Google what?
They're like, I think people try it all the time. It's just a critical mass
thing. Alternative to email. Everything in the world. Text messaging is an alternative to email. Any way that you communicate with another person in any way, smoke signals are an alternative to email. You know, it's just a communication. Anything that's communication is an alternative. And you know what? They never work. And you know why? I'm going to take a controversial stance here. Email is awesome.
What? Dude.
I like email. I write messages and I send it to people, and everybody has an address. Everybody's there. It's like the ultimate Facebook. You send it to them. Yeah. I don't have to answer you. Like the way that social has evolved around email is nobody's upset if they don't get an answer in 2 seconds. They're pleased if they are, but they understand if they don't get a response very quickly. There's no limits to what I can write. I can attach stuff. Everybody's got an address. It's just amazing. What's wrong with email? I love
you. Yeah. You drive a hard bargain there. But at the same time, one thing, like, so I think it's Frank Camaro. He maybe once said, like, email is pushing your problems off onto another person. And that's maybe a negative way to look at it. Frank's a typically positive guy. But I sometimes agree. I mean, it's like you're assigning a to-do or you're asking them, hey, how do I do this? Basically, you're like saying, I don't like this problem. You solve it for me. So I understand that. I wish I could maybe get that. But, you know, how do people get questions answered if we can't ask questions? I like email. Yeah. I think you just need
to... I see what you mean, though. And one of the mostly people's problems with email is they come into work on Monday and they hadn't checked it all weekend. There's 100 emails sitting there, and it feels like, God, my whole job's answering email. Why don't I have time to do any work? You know, it's because they have lame coworkers doing that thing of trying to push it off. Like, let's schedule. What do you think about this, Roger?
Yeah.
I do. I'm not trying to be cool. I hate it when people talk about Inbox Zero on Twitter because it's basically hashtag humble brag. Is if you have a problem with email, it means that you are, you know, that enough people like you and want your opinion that it's become a problem for you. You know, anybody that bitches about it, I'm like, yeah, that's kind of a good problem to have there, sister.
Yeah, well, mine's purely misorganization. I have about like 6,000 emails in my inbox. So if I ever get that, well, I have 1,100, and I got to zero like 2 months ago. So like that was a humble brag. That was awesome. Good job, me. Hey, good job. Nice great humble job. Brag. But like it's
about
just
20.
It's just my disorganization. I'm more like, hey, I conquered disorganization once. I did it this year, guys. So that's where my attitude.
There's probably strategies. Anyway. There's probably take a good long look through the top 100 at some point. Make sure that they're all kind of dealt with. And then just do the select all archive, right? And get yourself clean and then start better from then, right? Or is your 5,735th email possibly important?
I have no idea.
See,
I don't know. That's
maybe
the problem.
Bankruptcy time.
Yeah, maybe bankruptcy time. All right. Well, cool. Boom. I actually need to skip a question here. So sorry, we'll have to push this next one off. I just got a text. I have to unget my dog from the kennel. So I'm going to have to do that. That's weird. It's weird. It'll be apparently my dog is rowdy and she's totally disrupted the kennel. But anyway, let's do one more and then let's bust out of here. Does that sound good, Mr. Chris?
Super really quick one. Let's see. We have two left in our little
thing. Let's do the audio one.
Let's see.
Does that sound good?
Cooler than the other? Let's do the audio one just because those are better always.
Yeah.
Hey guys, this is a great podcast, one of my favorites, so thank you for all the hard work and everything you do. Just have a quick question about image replacement. I recently got into a little debate on an internet forum about, you know, the different techniques that have been around for a while, and there's somebody on there that was saying, oh, you know, all these different techniques of throwing text off the page or shrinking it to zero or all that stuff just shouldn't be used at all, and you should just be using actual image, like an, you know, an MTeX, and then use the alt text for whatever text you're trying to replace. And it just seems weird to me. It doesn't seem right. You know, the main thing I use image replacement for is for, you know, logos on websites. Like, so I'll take an H1 tag, put the name of the site, and then kick the text off and bring in a background image that has the logo, you know, and it seems like a good use.
Bark.
And to me, it just seems weird that all these, you know, really high-level people in our community and in our industry are using these image techniques, but somehow this person, and they were kind of getting a lot of attention. It was on Reddit, and they were getting a lot of upvotes and all that crap, and that they would feel this way. And it seems like that's such a simple thing, and why aren't all these people in the industry using it? And
so I'll stop. Yeah, I think he got the point. It's why aren't people using image replacement? Why are they just using image alt tags and an H1 and all that? Chris?
What do you think? Oh, I'll tell you what. I almost guarantee that just chucking an image in an H1 tag with an alt tag in there isn't as good of SEO as an H1 tag with actual text in it. I can't promise that. I'm not Google. They change stuff all the time. They could change back and forth. It could be different tomorrow. But I just get the feeling that an alt tag isn't as good as real text. So if you're Trent Walton, and Trent Walton wrote a post called, let's go. What's the latest trend? His latest blog article is Influx. If he just put H1 Influx, that's going to be better for someone Googling the word influx than it would be if he made that an image and put an image alt influx. It's not as good. That's why we don't do that. That's all. Okay. I'm just guessing, but I'm pretty confident. What do you think?
I think you're right. I have heard like conflicting, like, Google don't care. Google's smart, and Google is smart. So that's true. I don't know. Specifically with like a logo, I think he got into that. I used to always be like, logo is H1 all the time. Always, you know. But I've since backed down from that. It kind of doesn't matter.
I don't think it matters either.
I mean, honestly,
you're not, the point of the page should be the H1, if you ask me. But I think he's saying, like, it would be in an H1 no matter what. I mean, you would put the image in an H1. It just, there wouldn't be any text there. So maybe Google is smart enough to see what you're doing there. Be like, this is the title of the page. So treat the alt text in the same way that you would treat. But I doubt it.
There wasn't there a problem? Gosh, I wish I had a brain, like the history of the internet right before me. But wasn't there a problem with using CIFR, Shockwave Flash Image Replacement?
Shockwave? For, is that what it stood for?
Yeah, it was Shockwave Image Replacement for your headlines. Like, you can basically like load up a flash file to be the H1 or something. Mm-hmm. I want to say there was like a problem with that accessibility wise,
because it would rip the H1 out of the DOM and replace it with flash, or maybe not, or it would display none it or something. I bet that was the accessibility problem. But at least in the markup, it was still an H1 with text in it.
Yeah, I guess so.
Accessibility is different than it.
I would always err on the side of using text when you can.
Yes, good old semantic markup. Posh.
Yeah, posh. Posh coding.
You could be right, though. Google could treat it the same way and make me look like an idiot. But you know what? You don't know. I don't know. Nobody knows. Error on the safe side.
Well, and like, if you don't want to make all those images, it's just not going to be as natural. It's going to slow down your page speed. If you're talking about Google problems, slowing down the page speed is a problem. I guess he's saying like just image replacing. So I guess you'd still have an image. Derp, 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 derp.
Yeah, we get you though.
I get I get you. Yeah.
All right, go get your dog, man.
I gotta go get my dog. But hey, phew, thank you so much. That was Gabe Luthi, I think, is how you pronounce his last name. Gabe, thanks for sending in that question. So yeah, another rapid fire episode. I gotta go get my dog, but thanks for listening. And
see you next time,
Chris,
folks.
On
trapdogshow.com.